We're doing a Q&A session here with Mark Vernon. He's the author of A Secret History of Christianity, Jesus, the Last Inkling, and the Evolution of Consciousness. Thanks for joining us, Mark.
Very much for inviting me. Delighted to be talking.
So how's the reception been on the book so far? I know you've been doing a little bit of touring. I've seen some of the stuff on your YouTube channel. How's that? How's the reception going?
It's going well. I'm getting the sense that it is touching people. It is making them intrigued, particularly those who haven't heard of Barfield before, or only very slightly, maybe through C.S. Lewis and the Inklings, are thinking, goodness me, you know, maybe this really has got something to offer for understanding Christianity now, opening things up again. So that's pleasing. I'm hoping there might be a review or two as well, particularly in the UK religious press, and that's yet to come. But you know, my own efforts, not least, you know, our talking, is creating a hope, a sense of word of mouth.
Now, what kind of I'm curious, what is your typical audience been like? Is it more motivated or directed towards people that are kind of within the church or without? Who do you see kind of taking up and being the most interested in the book?
I think it's going to be people who have some sense that Christianity matters, but they're also very aware that the modern world, Christianity doesn't automatically fit into the modern world, and that particularly, I think, with the sense of the significance of Jesus now, that, you know, if, say, older accounts of salvation don't feel enough, you know, as if there's something in them, but they're not quite enough, or alternatively, people who are very interested in the way that history itself seems to be important, not just, as it were, that there was a moment in history where this figure of Jesus appeared, but that, in a way, what's happened since, which links to the idea that Barfield wrote so much about, the evolution of consciousness. So it's give Christians, I think, mostly, who are seeking a new kind of relevance for Christianity, particularly in the West. Aware that it seems to be falling away for many people, and only being reasserted in you know, in relatively literal ways, perhaps, which they don't find wholly satisfying. To put it another way, perhaps people who are aware that the criticisms of religion that arise, broadly speaking, from the scientific materialism, the scientific worldview, they have a sense that the way to respond to that is not to try and do a kind of Christian apologetics that defends, say, the veracity of the resurrection, which they get a sense that this feels like a kind of never-ending effort to try and keep the doctrine propped up, and that's not really going to work. But rather they want a sense that maybe scientific materialism itself is too narrow a sense of reality, a view of reality. I mean, that what's really required is a re-expansion of our sense of the way things are in the world, in ourselves, the cosmos, in relation to the divine. And Barfield is so brilliant because he provides a way that both touches material reality as we know it, but opens it onto a wider spiritual reality. So it's kind of has this expansive sense. He's neither trying to, as it were, just dismiss scientific materialism, but nor is he just thinking that we can only operate within what scientific materialism says about the way things are.
Yeah, so for those who are completely unfamiliar with Barfield or just kind of dipping their toe in the water with him, could you just lay out kind of a brief definition for how you see those concepts of, like, say, original participation and final participation?
So Barfield he wasn't alone in this, but Barfield, to my mind, developed a very compelling account of how the evolution of consciousness changes. And by that, he meant that human beings over time, over periods of cultural time particularly, so over centuries, have very different perceptions of the world, themselves, nature, the cosmos, and gods. And in particular, because he tracked this through his study of words, and which I particularly like because, you know, this is an evidential approach as well as a felt perceptual approach. He noticed how words, say as used in ancient Greek texts like Homer's texts, or say in the oldest bits of the Hebrew Bible, how they suggest that people back then, say 3,000 years ago, experienced life as a kind of flow or flood even of meaning, that they didn't have a sense really of themselves at all as separate from others, separate from nature, separate from the gods, but that rather the task of life back then was to negotiate this kind of flow of meaning. It was a much more collective sense, very sophisticated in its own way, but a much more collective sense. And that gradually, as he put it, this flow of meaning withdrew from people's immediate perceptions of life. And people felt at different times and in different ways alienated from the world around them. This has the downside of alienation. He called it a withdrawal of participation, but it has the upside that one's own sense of interiority and individuality develops. And he thought that what can happen is that with that intensification of your own inner life, that is a new source of life that can then flow out back into the world. To use a kind of Christian notion that the spirit that you once breathed in can be breathed out once more, and that life can return, the new perception of the inner life of all things can return, but with the difference that it's based on your own inner life, your own inner vitality, and that introduces a new kind of freedom into the world. And there's a lot more that could be said about this, but he really thought that was the key to the Christian dispensation, that it's a new kind of freedom that's catalyzed by the person of Jesus, that becomes available to us all.
So I know in Barfield's writing, he kind of communicates this very strong sense that quite a bit is riding on this sort of humanity's discovery of final participation in some sense. Like there's a, and I'm curious if you have some thoughts on kind of Barfield's view of, say the Christian version of the apocalypse and things of that nature, because it's almost a sense in which he seems to think that perhaps maybe that God is in some sense voluntarily beholden himself to kind of partnering with humanity, and that we need, there's this turn that we need to make, otherwise civilization has itself is in some sort of jeopardy. Would you agree with that characterization, or how would you say that you think Barfield sees that?
It's complicated, and that there are, I think, different valid ways of talking about this, which I think is generally the case for spiritual truths. Because different ways of talking about it capture different aspects of something that we're still evolving towards. But broadly speaking, I think Barfield felt that creation itself is an outpouring from the divine, from spiritual reality. And as that outpouring unfolds, so particularly material reality as we know it, most immediately anyway, becomes more and more well-defined, which has its own advantages. So for example, we as individuals can know ourselves in particular times and places, which clearly is very, very key to our sense of being persons, to being individuals as we are. We're definitely speaking in 2019, and with all that implies, for example, using the internet in the way that we are. But it has the disadvantage that spiritual reality can feel distant, maybe even absent. Now it's possible for people to feel that, quite obviously. What he felt, I think, is that the return to the divine which I don't think he saw it in apocalyptic terms, in say the way that it's certainly clear in some strands of Christianity. I think he saw it much more in, say, Johannine terms. You know, the Gospel of John doesn't have apocalyptic material, but instead talks about the light coming into the world, that's the light of all people, the logos, that underpins the world, that shapes and forms and creates the world. As it were, it invites us to become co-creators, co-participants, with that life, and that this is the kind of moment that we're in now, that having been created by the Logos, we're being invited to rediscover the Logos so that we can, not just, as it were, be dragged back, or saved by a kind of a divine intervention in which we have no part. I think that God's plan, you might say, is much more sophisticated than that. That God wants us to know the divine in ourselves, to rediscover our spiritual nature, which is there all along, and so be swept back up into a divine vision, holy ourselves, as well as holy at one with divine purposes once again. So it's not such a catastrophic vision of things, in the sort of apocalyptic sense. But it is nonetheless a kind of struggle, and it is tricky that we're called to participate in this with everything that we've got, you know, to sort of stake our lives on it, and because there's nothing less than all of us, that God wants to draw back to himself, by our becoming aware of the Logos, through the evolution of our own perceptions. I think it's something like that that Barfield talked about, the future, a future participation.
Yeah, he does though. I mean, I guess I read, maybe I'm reading into this too much, but he seems to be pointing that, like, if there's a somewhat of a fear in him that, like, you know, where we have this certain trend line right now that he's analyzing, that we're turning further and further away from the divine in some sense, and that there's always a fear that if we don't course correct, that, you know, we'll get to this point where, in some sense, the divine is some important component of even our ability to communicate with one another, that we'll lose that even, like, our sense of what he calls the collective representations. It requires this sort of commune with the divine consciousness for us to have any ability to really communicate, to not have our own little private worlds that are isolated from everybody else. And you know, I'm just curious, you know, do you, like, where do you see us at in this process? And, like, you know, do you see any sort of trends in positively in the other direction that are possibly, you know, the tide is turning?
I mean, I think Barfield was writing at what you might call sort of peak mechanical consciousness. So in psychology, certainly in the West, for much of his life, it was dominated by behaviorism, which tried to treat human beings' psyches as if they were machines, you know, kind of sort of cause effect response machines. Clearly, you know, he knew both the First and the Second World Wars and saw Europe in complete meltdown. I think that he saw, I think, a struggle in science. On the one hand, I think he saw the dominance of a very mechanistic version of Darwinism, that came to the fore. But he also, of course, saw the revolution in physics, the end of a mechanical physics with the birth of quantum mechanics, particularly, which, whilst it's still debated very heavily what that means in terms of reality itself, it certainly has completely disturbed the old ideas about a mechanical physics. You know, probability is the way that you deal with reality if you're a physicist now, not just push and pull of Newton's second law of motion. So I think that he both saw the real tragedy of the world in the 20th century. But I think he did also see signs of a turn. You know, he did talk about being at the bottom of a sort of U shape, but seeing signs of a turn. So whilst I think he did see it as really, really serious, and that the meaning crisis really is a crisis, and the rediscovery of meaning is not remotely straightforward. I think that he did see the signs of a renewed participation. I mean, had he lived a little bit longer, I think that he would have, for example, looked at the ecological crisis, which now has become very pressing, as both the potential for disaster, but also the moment where a new ecological awareness arises. And that's really significant because it's an ecological awareness that's not just about being aware that we share this planet in all sorts of carefully crafted systems and so on, but it's an awareness that there's a kind of intelligence embedded in nature. And it's when you start to perceive of the world around you as carrying sort of qualities that we normally associate with people, like intelligence, that you're starting, I think, to get back to a participation which he felt that our ancient ancestors just felt immediately.
Here in Paul's community, a lot of people have been following along with a series of lectures that have been being given by John Vervaeke. I'm curious, have you, and they're all on this topic of the meaning crisis is kind of what he's been working through. I'm curious, have you had any engagement with his work or see any parallels with, you know, specifically what you're writing about here and or, you know, what Barfield was working on?
Yeah, I mean, I haven't watched them all, but I certainly have watched a number of John Vervaeke's discussions and really enjoyed them. You know, they're incredibly rich. What my overall sense, and I'm happy to stand corrected here if this isn't the case, because I haven't watched them all, but my overall sense is that Vervaeke is working from a point of view which is quite widespread, which is recognizing there's a meaning crisis, but feeling that it's the human task alone to try and find a way out of the meaning crisis, to, as it were, pull ourselves back up by our own bootstraps. Mm-hmm. And I think that that is sort of fundamentally a flawed approach. A lot can be learned on the way, but I think it's fundamentally flawed. And Barfield would definitely say this. He would call it something like a residual unresolved positivism. And instead, he would say that it's not that that kind of task is completely worthless, but it won't achieve its aims unless it also realizes that the task is not just to lift ourselves up, but is to become reconnected to the consciousness that's all around us. And this is where the imagination for him is so important, and why he is very much part of the romantic strand that John Vervaeke talks about. That the imagination is that part of our inner vitality that can, as it were, leap out of ourselves and rediscover the vitality that's around us in a kind of inspiration that comes back at us. The one talk of Vervaeke's, which I listened to very keenly, was the one when he talked about the Romantic tradition. And I think what he didn't give the Romantic tradition enough credence of is that it had overcome the Kantian problem of knowing the thing in itself. I think figures like Coleridge and others, through the sense of the imagination, they did answer Kant's problem about how we can know the noumenal as well as the phenomenal. For me, that's the strand that needs to be picked up and developed and amplified, not just, as it were, the turn inwards with talk of psychotechnologies and so on, which are sort of invigorating. I mean, you know, the human mind in itself is quite a fascinating thing. But at the end of the day, I think we need to recognize that the human mind is not at our skulls in kind of splendid isolation or even in groups of skulls knocking together, but that it is embedded in an intelligence that is in the cosmos itself.
Yeah, I think that is a fair kind of characterization of Vervaeke's views. One of his students had a conversation. His name was Christopher Mastro Pietro. Had a conversation with Paul where he kind of hauntingly pointed out that, you know, in light of John's work, that we're kind of living in the afterglow of a dying star, with the dying star being, you know, this Christianity that we still have kind of some light and warmth from, but that's going away, and that we have to kind of invent something new. So I think you're right in characterizing this as like we gotta now pull up ourselves by our own bootstraps and start anew, which I think is it's it, in some sense it only accentuates more the meaning crisis, the idea that we gotta go invent a new religion really fast.
I mean, I think you see it in the kind of proliferation of, say, approaches in the cognitive sciences. Essentially, you can always sort of sense when people fear that they're skating across a void, because they can't actually rest. There's no space, for example, for silence, and for listening, for attending. It's all about trying to grasp and understand and capture. It's very much in the feel of it as well as it is in the sort of logic of it.
Yeah, so could you, you know, one of the things that becomes interesting to talk about with Barfield is his specific definition of the imagination that you kind of picked up on in your last response. Could you go into some more detail about how he saw it? Because, and again, I think this is something within the modern rational frame, imagination kind of has this sense of whimsy and fancy. And I think, you know, Barfield was getting on something completely different when he refers to the imagination.
Yeah, I mean, he broadly used the Coleridgean, the Samuel Taylor Coleridge distinction between fantasy and imagination proper. And Coleridge, and this is slightly my take on it as a psychotherapist, because I think this is also how it works in psychotherapy. But in this romantic tradition, broadly speaking, it's recognized that our minds, if you like, our inner lives are kind of like fantasy generators. We do it all day, every day. It's how we kind of find our way through the world by not just sort of perceiving directly, but using past experience, cultural experience, et cetera, to already sort of load our perceptions with meaning. But often those meanings are mistaken. I mean, sometimes they're just a bit too limited because they're shaped by our culture or our past too much. Sometimes they're just plain wrong. But what Coleridge said is that you can tell when fantasy is moving into what he called imagination proper, because it itself becomes generative, it itself becomes creative, and it takes you to new places. It opens up the world and expands your own sense of life. So, for example, I mean, I think Einstein was onto this. Einstein was very interested in the imagination because his discoveries, which became tangible science, you know, empirically based science and so on, but they began with imaginative exercises when, for example, he imagined riding on the beam of a light wave and what that might be like. Now, that sounds like a sort of childish fantasy, and Einstein did actually say you need something of the childlike to be a good scientist. But the point is it really took him somewhere to pursue that fantasy. And so he said it became imagination proper, that out of that imagination could it almost, like, you can imagine dropping bits of scientific knowledge that then become very particular entities, objects that you can develop and prove in all sorts of ways. But imagination proper is when it really takes you somewhere where it becomes productive in itself. And then Coleridge and Barfield add the extra layer is that the reason why imagination proper becomes creative and lasting is because it's an echo of the divine imagination. Others like William Blake have said this too, that they recognize that the divine creative act is itself a kind of imaginative outflow, an imaginative outpouring. But with the divine, it's always productive, it's always creative, and it always leads to more. But we can share in that imaginative activity too. You know, we do it to some degree, even when we speak, and when a word feels like it really captures a moment, maybe it's a poetic word, and that's an echo of the Logos's activity in creation, constantly amplifying, rejoicing, taking pleasure in discovering new aspects of reality, that sort of expansive sense of the imagination. And not just fantasy as a kind of whim, which may be amusing, but almost immediately sort of falls flat.
Yeah, I think you went into this in some detail in your last chapter in your book, which was We Must Be Mystics, which I really enjoyed a lot. There's quite a bit packed in there in terms of trying to look at how we can use the imagination in a way that we can have it's again not some sort of whimsical fancy, but something that's actually in contact with reality. I'm curious, you know, do you have any plans to write any more about this topic moving into the future? Because it seems like you're kind of just doing this wide exploration, and then you get to the final chapter and you really have a lot packed in there about, you know, what your response to it is. I'm curious if you're would be looking to write more about it.
I mean, it's all work in progress for me, of course. I think that what I wanted hope to achieve in the last chapter was to give people a sort of felt sense that they can know the activity of the Logos in their own lives through the operation of the imagination. It's, you know, for example, C.S. Lewis was onto this too, that it's when, for example, you hear music, think about what's actually going on in music, which is very remarkable, that something that's purely acoustic in terms of the science, you know, the vibrations in the air, the minute you perceive them, they're, you know, already massively enriched. You know, because you hear music, you hear tunes, you hear harmonies, you hear melodies, you hear discord. It's pleasant, it's unpleasant. And then, of course, it also carries emotion and may soothe you, console you, invite you to new experiences of reality. You know, so this is something that happens all day, every day. But you have to turn your attention to it, unpack it a bit, to realize that you're already immersed in this participation in life. I think Barfield also got this from Steiner. Rudolf Steiner is someone I'm grappling with too. I don't mention Steiner in my book because I just felt I couldn't write about him at great length. But one of the things which I had gleaned from Steiner is that it's when you not just have an experience and recognize that you're an experiencer of an experience, but when you reflect on the nature of experiencing itself, that's when a kind of inner life opens up, and it becomes a reality that you can return to time and time again and develop. So I was hoping that my reflections on imagination in my last chapter would sort of show, as well as convince, people who are broadly in the Christian tradition that this is something that's happening already, and kind of awaken them to that. I think it's what the incarnation means now. If the incarnation is not just something that happened 2,000 years ago, but is the constant operation of the Logos in creation, in our own lives, inner lives, and the inner lives of all things, that becoming aware of how the imagination brings everything to life is to become aware of how the incarnation brings everything to life, in fact. And it's ongoing now. And so that feels to me to be the first absolutely crucial step. And the minute you can take that step, other things can unfold. It was the first crucial step I really need to take as well, and to sort of try and get clear in my own sense. So that's why the book kind of finishes with that.
Interesting. Yeah. So speaking of Spiner, Josh just asked in the Q&A chat, he's curious what ways in which you think Barfield was in agreement with anthroposophy and where maybe he differed, or because I know, you know, even later in life, you know, after he had joined the Church of England and was, you know, a confirmed Anglican, he still would recommend Steiner pretty much to everybody, and kind of still had a sense in which Steiner had some sort of practical means of elaborating on what he was kind of I guess dealing with in a more theoretical sense with some of his writings.
Yeah, Barfield does, even in the books where he hardly mentions Steiner, like Saving the Appearances and Poetic Diction, he will say, you know, I've discovered what I've discovered through my own ways, particularly study of words, but Steiner has discovered it too, sort of enfold, and so he would recommend looking at Steiner's work. I think Barfield, for me, has the advantage that he writes in a way which is more accessible, because he's writing about consciousness, he's writing about words, rather than the... Steiner writes in two modes broadly. One is quite abstract philosophy, which, you know, it quite analytical, really, which requires a certain mindset. But then also, particularly lately, more lately, Steiner writes in these very esoteric ways, which are often just very hard to know what to make sense of, I think. And it, to my mind, has had the slightly unfortunate effect that anthroposophy can often take on a rather dogmatic feel because people fall back on quoting Steiner, you know, and rather than, I think, really knowing what Steiner was experiencing from the inside themselves. And I think that Barfield did, though. That Barfield recognized that he should mostly write from what he knew himself. And that's why he, I think, can both be on the same page as Steiner, but be more accessible than a lot of anthroposophical writing. You know, Steiner himself said this. I mean, this is no discredit to Steiner. He said he did not want followers. He wanted people who experienced this too. And I think, in a way, you might say that Barfield was a true follower of Steiner in that sense, that he did stick to that. Every so often, in some of his less known writings, Barfield will it develops the feel where he's more reporting what Steiner said. So, for example, he wrote a dialogue called An Ancestral Voice, where you can sort of almost see Barfield tussling, wrestling with what Steiner had said to see whether he can bring it alive in his own way. And he sort of does and he doesn't in that book, to my mind anyway. But the crucial thing is to know it yourself. This is where the freedom lies. You know, both Steiner and Barfield and others too, Blake, who are on a very similar page, I think, William Blake. The point is to be spiritually free yourself, to know this for yourself. And if you turn to writings and try to sort of imitate them or adopt them as if they're almost sets of creeds or doctrines, then, you know, develops this feel of not being free, actually. So I think Barfield was very aware of that in the anthroposophical community. You know, it divided after Steiner died, particularly in Britain. There was sort of internecine disputes. And whilst he certainly did write lots for anthroposophical publications, my sense is at least that he didn't get completely absorbed in that, and that he couldn't, in a way, because his wife, Maud, and also his friendship with C.S. Lewis, kept him, you know, firmly plugged into other circles as well, which perhaps was a good thing, although I've no doubt that it was a very difficult tension to bear at times.
I'm curious too about I know you've also written on Carl Jung, and I'm curious if you see any interaction or similarities between what some of what Jung was doing, what Barfield is doing. You know, specifically, you know, I know in certain books, like in Saving the Appearances, Barfield kind of almost points at Jung in terms of his idea of the collective unconscious and his idea of what he would call the collective representations as being sort of a collective conscious, that he kind of was chiding people that they would be willing to accept the collective unconscious, but not have this sense of the collective conscious. And also their ideas about, you know, how you use imagination as a means of exploration and discovery. Do you see any kind of parallels in terms of their thinking?
I think there are. I mean, I think that Barfield, say in Saving the Appearances, I think it is, he does say he recognizes that psychotherapy, psychoanalysis, analytical psychology, which is the sort of Jungian version of it, is beneficial to people, particularly therapeutically. But I think he remained wary of it as a spiritual undertaking. I think because he felt that in Jung, there's a kind of unresolved Kantianism, that. And Jung can be like this at times. He can seem to be a very good Kantian, in the sense that he'll talk about the archetypes that populate the collective unconscious. But he'll say we can never know the archetypes in themselves. We only ever know how they manifest to us, which is when they interact with our own psyches. And so, say we put flesh on the bones of the archetype of the mother, or flesh on the bones of the archetype of the trickster, that we can never know the thing in itself. And for Barfield, that would be the collective unconscious rather than the collective conscious, which he was much more pressing towards. And so that when Jung's like that, I think that Barfield becomes critical. But you know, Jung is a slippery fish as well, and other times he will say much more directly that he does know the thing in itself. You know, he doesn't believe he knows. He famously says on occasions, and that whilst in one mode he is being an empiricist and a scientist, which is broadly Kantian in its approach, just looking at the phenomena, looking at the behavior, gathering the evidence, in another mode, he will say that he does engage with a thing in itself. And this has become much clearer since the Red Book, Jung's famous great work, was published, where clearly he goes on his own esoteric journey, and was drawing directly on his own spiritual experience, where he encounters intelligences, he encounters spiritual beings. I think, you know, Jung was trying to straddle worlds. He was drawing on his own personal experience and trying to devise a psychology for the 20th and now 21st century, that could be widely utilized without necessarily having to have the direct spiritual experiences. You know, to be fair to Jung, partly because he realized many people wouldn't be able to access that very directly, and so they need some sort of intermediate discipline. And for Jung, this is to come back to the imagination. This is where the imagination comes in Jung, that Jung too argued that people should, as he puts it, amplify the imagination. You know, if you have a dream, stay with the imagery of the dream and go back into it. Let the characters in the dream live, see where they go, see if they take on a life of their own. And whilst Jung and Steiner were not at all friendly towards one another, they could say quite rude things about each other at times. Nonetheless, I think that they were onto the same thing ultimately, that this use of the imagination, use of the amplification, so that the contents of the psyche start to take on a life of their own, entering into that world. I think that they're both on the same terrain there, and that modern psychotherapy does this quite routinely. It wouldn't necessarily talk about it in those terms, but the way that one tries to use images, play would be another word that has come in certainly into British psychotherapy. That's what this is all about. For many people, that takes them into an encounter with spiritual reality that has its own objectivity as well.
Very good. I have a question here that was forwarded to me by Eilif. He adds, he noted in your last conversation with Paul, you had a comment towards the end where you were saying something about life's mysteries are a preparation for what comes next. And he was curious if you could elaborate on that some more.
Yeah, well, it's my intimations, my imagination letting that run with me a little bit. But you know, if I think part of our task in this life is to perceive more and more of the world around us, reality around us, and the reason why it's a task for life is because it is a working on yourself. It's this strange dialectic of both understanding yourself, and coming to know yourself more and more and more, particularly in your inner life. But at the same time, that process is at once a dying to yourself, to use the Christian terms, because you start to realize there's more going on than just yourself, when you can get over yourself to some degree, let go of yourself. Though that letting go, I think, requires, first of all, to have a keen sense of what you're trying to let go of. Otherwise, it just becomes a kind of denigration of the self. So that process, which takes place throughout life, if it leads to an expansion of our perception of reality here and now, and both in terms of nature and in terms of the divine, and then the spiritual ecology that I think exists in the world around us too, then that must be, I think, a preparation for the next life. I mean, I get this actually not only from Barfield, but I think that it was a perception that's in the Platonic tradition, particularly in Socrates. I mean, if you read, say, the Apology, which is one of the Platonic dialogues that relates the Socratic experience of approaching death, then it seems to me that Plato's clearly saying that Socrates had, as it were, one foot in this life and one foot in the next life. And that the reason why he could approach death with equanimity was because he was already half living in the next world that was also here. He was still here. And I think that that actually is a perception of Christian mysticism too, that heaven is not another place. Heaven is here already, and that we're asked, invited to prepare ourselves for the next life by increasingly realizing that it's here too. And so death loses its sting. It is a kind of transition rather than a complete interruption. So that's the way that both through my reading and, you know, in its very limited sense, my sense of life unfolding too, that's the direction in which it's kind of headed. It's not a universal Christian perception of things. You know, the more apocalyptic, the more we will sleep and then rise approaches in Christianity would see death as an abrupt end, which we're wholly reliant upon the intervention of the divine to rescue us from. That would be another approach. So it's a real absolute dying, and then a real absolute rising in a rather more literal sense. But I think that there's something always more subtle going on when you start to get into the spiritual reading of these things, this dying and this rising. You know, in one way, at the end of the day, of course, it all depends upon the divine. All life depends upon the divine. But I do think that it's very strong in Christian mysticism and other spiritual traditions that one of the key things about being human is that we're asked to become co-workers, to recognize the spirit within us, the logos within us. That's the tremendous invitation. And I think that even includes the perception of what it might be to die and rise in the here and now too.